You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When word spread around the world last September that a 22-year-old Iranian woman by the name of Mahsa Amini died following an apparent attack by Tehran's morality police after supposedly not wearing her headdress properly, the hijab, protests broke out around the world, and more notably in Iran. The protests were some of the largest seen in years, and her death not only put the spotlight on Iran's controversial government standards, but it also brought attention to the country's way of life and those who are desperately seeking to change it. According to Iran Human Rights, almost 500 people were killed by the Iranian security forces by December of last year. Amnesty International also reported that protesters were fired upon in groups with live ammunition, while others were beaten to death. All of this as the balance of power right now in the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and Asia seems to be at a crossroads, especially as Russia continues its war on Ukraine and China steps up its alliance with Russia, and of course, the brewing tension between the U.S. and China over the future of Taiwan. Academic, novelist, and decorated U.S. Foreign Service officer Ambassador John Limbert will give a presentation on the future of Iran-U.S. relations in Sacramento. Ambassador Limbert joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. Pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to have you. You have such a rich history in public service, and I really want to start there for some context ahead of our deeper conversation about Iran. You first visited Iran when your parents were working for the United States Agency for International Development, and that focuses on humanitarian efforts, but then you returned to Iran with the Peace Corps. What drew you to this country and its culture?
That's a good question. It's been part of my life now for about 55 years. I think about it. When I first went there, John Kennedy was president of the United States. Think about that. When I tell my students, they say, "Was that before or after Lincoln?" That's what they ask me. But I suppose, and I'm not alone in this. I'm one of those people who was probably affected by the incurable Iran virus. And for better or worse, it's been part of my life now for about 55 or 60 years, including, I should note, that I am part of a very proud and cultured Iranian-American family. So I'm a son-in-law, I'm a brother-in-law, I'm a parent, grandparent, all of which people create this tie, which goes very deep in my case. Mm.
You joined the Foreign Service in the early 1970s, and you were posted in several locations around the world, including ambassador to Mauritania from 2000 to 2003, and that's a country located in Northwest Africa, bordering Mali and near Morocco. But let's focus on 1979. That was more than 40 years ago. You were serving as a Foreign Service officer at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran when it was overtaken by Iranian students, leading to the hostage crisis there. You were one of more than 50 Americans held captive for over a year. Share with us some of your experiences during that very uncertain and dangerous situation.
Well, I can say it was definitely not pleasant, not something that we expected to happen. I mean, we thought we were dealing with once President Carter, whom I admire a great deal, but once he made the decision to admit the Shah to the United States, and we were left in place, we knew something bad was going to happen. We didn't know what, but we figured. I mean, we were finished. We were. The message was, "You're expendable. Good luck to you out there."
Yeah, and you can.
And what we thought we were dealing with originally was a 70s style student sit-in. I mean, some of us remember that. Some of your audience probably remembers those. But within 48 hours, this turned in from a student sit-in into a international melodrama that cost President Carter his presidency.
I mean, you continued on with decades of foreign service. How did that shape the work that you do?
I think it did. It made me much more determined to follow the values of diplomacy, because I saw what happens when diplomacy collapses. And what we had was anarchy, and it wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty. It was violent. It was dangerous, and not just what happened to us, but even worse, what happened to our Iranian friends and family. I mean, that tur it turned their country into this violent, repressive, brutal place that basically ignored the laws and ignored the rules.
You say that the current events, like the tension over the death of Mahsa Amini, has been brewing for a long time. The fuel has been there. What do you mean by that?
Well, we talk in our country. I mean, here in the U.S., we talk a lot about culture wars, and we're seeing them play out. Iran has probably been in culture war on steroids for over 6 or 7 centuries. There is always there are sort of conflicting strains. There's the strain that looks at religiosity and imposing a very strict version of religion on people whose, in many cases, whose natural instincts go in another direction. They enjoy, like most of us, they enjoy having a drink occasionally. They enjoy music. They want to enjoy their lives. And there are those out there who tell them, no, you can't do that. Here's the way you have to dress. You have to observe all the fasts. You have to observe all the prayers. No music. No movies. And no fun, basically. Iranians, like, again, are no different for the rest of us. They want to enjoy themselves, and so you have this tension going back centuries. And what it, among the other things, it produced some of the world's greatest poetry and greatest literature. And the masterpieces of Persian literature stem out of this culture war, in which the poet says, yes, I am a good religious person, but I must say, if I'm going to drink wine, I want it to be good wine. And if I'm going to sin, I want it to be a good sin. So that's been around for a long time. And the version of rules that were imposed after 1979 go against the instincts of most people. I mean, look at Iranian art, its color, its beauty. This artistic strain goes very deep, and these very creative people want to express themselves in some way. And they've been pushed down for 40 or 45 years, and now what you're seeing is enough. We've had enough. We've had enough of your rule. We've got young people. We've got creative people. We've got savvy people like Mahsa and her contemporaries. They're not going to stand for these rules anymore. I mean, maybe the government, by brute force, can impose its will, but I'm not sure for how long.
A piece of this is also involves the United States, and your perspective also includes foreign service, it includes diplomacy. Why has the relationship between the United States and Iran been so difficult over the past 40 plus years? That's a that's a big question. I understand that.
Wonderful question. That was when I taught after I left the Foreign Service. I taught for 12 years at the U.S. Naval Academy. I loved it. Jimmy Carter's alma mater, by the way. And that was my final exam question to the students, and they came up with some pretty interesting answers, basically looking at the history. But one of them came to me and said, "Professor, what's the answer? What's the answer to the question?" And the only thing I could say was, I'll be darned if I know, because it really has defied all expectations for us to remain hostile for this long. I mean, we reestablished relations with the Soviet Union about 15 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. We reestablished relations with China First with President Nixon, then with President Carter. Cuba, we've reestablished relations. Vietnam, we reestablished relations very quickly. And the question is, why in the case of Iran, where the history is actually much less violent, the confrontations in most cases were much less violent, why in the case of Iran has it been so difficult? What is special about it?
What's happening currently? I mean, Mahsa Amini died more than 6 months ago, but there's even reporting this week that Iran is starting to use cameras and facial identification to look for and crack down on women who don't wear the hijab or wear it improperly. And then, although we don't know who exactly is responsible, there are also reports of young female school children who are refusing to wear the hijab and are being gassed with poison, as well as cafes being raided and shut down over the headscarf. And there's protests that are continuing. I mean, is this frustration in Iran reaching a boiling point? And what do you make of the protests? Are they effective, and will they be effective?
I've given up on the practice of prediction in the case of Iran. The reason being, I've been wrong so many times, and I suppose. If you're going to talk about Iran, the first requirement is that you be ready to be wrong a lot, because you're going to be. It's defied prediction. I did not predict the revolution in 78, 79. I didn't predict the very harsh and brutal direction that it would go. I didn't predict that we and the Iranians would be estranged for so long. But it's very clear. The tie between most of the population, which is young, which is savvy, which is creative, which is itching to join the world, to use their creativity, particularly the women. The Iranian women are remarkable. I know that from my own family. And if you have any contact with Iranians, you would know that. But it's amazing. And I think this government is terrified of the women, terrified of the Iranian women, and so does everything it can to repress them, including enforcing dozens of minute rules about how they should dress, how they should walk, where they could work, what they can study, where they can study, what they can do. And in spite of this, their best efforts, the Islamic Republic now is facing a large contingent of young and very well-educated women. I mean, think of it, 60, 65% of the students in universities now are women. I asked my wife, why is that so? And she said, well, it's very simple. They're smarter. So there you are. And frankly, the people in power, for the most part, have no response other than more brutality, more pressure, more rules, more restrictions. Mm-hmm. How long they can keep that up, you know, I don't know. I would love to see something better there. I'd love to see something better there today, but I don't know. I don't know when that's going to happen. But how long they can keep up just enforcing rules put in by a group of men, of old men who've been in power now for 40 some years, I don't think that's a lasting model for governance.
So then, what for you? What is a barometer for successful change in the country?
That's a good question. That's a very good question, Vicky. Ask a dozen people, you'll get a dozen different answers. For a while, I mean, in the 90s, and then maybe 10 years ago, there was hope that reform movements within the system would lead to change. It hasn't worked out. There are others who say no. It's hopeless. you know, the Islamic Republic, root and branch, it just has to go. And that's fine if you have something to replace it. Because I'm old enough, I remember the uprisings of 78, 79, when basically everybody left, right, and center, religious, secular, moderate, whatever, said, the Shah must go. We've got to get rid of the Shah. And if you ask what comes after, everybody had an idea, but the basic thing was it had to be better. Okay, get rid of the Islamic Republic. I would shed no tear for it. But what comes after? Is it necessarily going to be better? I mean, we have the examples of the Arab Spring, 10, 12 years ago. Things didn't necessarily get better. And of course, in the case of Iran, we have the examples of 78, 79. So I don't know what is going to replace it. We want it. Everybody wants it to be better. And people, it's very easy to say what you don't want. To say what you do want is hard. That's really hard. Part of the problem is that if you say you want a democratic Iran, but what does that mean? One thing it means is you have to respect the opinions of others. You have to listen to the opinions of others, and you have to be open to criticism. And that hasn't, unfortunately, we haven't seen much of that in the country's politics over the past years. Over the past decades, I should say.
Right. And as a consequence of that, I mean, the United States has a large Iranian diaspora, especially here in California. What role, if any, does the Iranian diaspora play in the political dynamics back in Iran?
The arguments with, you're right about the diaspora. I mean, California, Northern, it seems to me there are like two diasporas almost, the Northern and the Southern California one, which are quite different, but quite large and very well established. I mean, the accomplishments of people in the arts, and academia, and science, and business, just amazing. But at the end of the day, you raise the question, and again, something I don't have a good answer for is, are they going to be the people who determine which direction the country goes, or is it going to be inside? And I know in 78, 79, there were powerful groups in the diaspora, very articulate groups, who thought that they would have a voice in the new system. It turned out they didn't. It turned out that there were much more powerful forces inside that basically overwhelmed the groups from outside. So I'll put my Iran expert hat on and say, I don't know. But the diaspora is, I mean, it's articulate, it's interesting. There are fascinating debates among the directions of different groups. But all of that is with the caveat that it is possible that the real change and the real impetus for change will come from inside. But we don't know so much about that. What are the different currents? What are the different groups? Because by necessity, they have to operate underground. Mm-hmm.
Finally, Ambassador, you know, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, there are more reports out just this week. Iran is buying more fuel from Russia as both countries are under sanctions by the United States. We know that. I mean, you know very well these things don't exist in silos, right? These relations. Where do U.S.-Iranian relations stand today, and how will this impact those relations?
Well, this relationship with Russia, just very quickly, Russia has nothing for Iran. But arms, maybe. I mean, they say they can buy arms. Although Russia seems to need its arms right now. Russia is Iran's historic enemy. I mean, if the U.S. and Iran were hostile, that's nothing to what went on between U.S. between Iran and Russia. And the fact that Iran has been forced to make nice with the Russians, to me, is an indication of the bankruptcy of Iran's current foreign policy, because there is nothing there for it. I mean, what can they get from Russia? But again, this and what they have done, I don't think it's very popular, because people have long memories. We say that Iran never forgets anything in its history. Americans, on the other hand, we forget everything, but Iranians forget nothing. And they have not forgotten about what Russia has done in Iran over a very long time.
Ambassador John Limbert, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Vicky. Pleasure.
And an early welcome to Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.